From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He was the messenger from Mars, Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane, the thin white duke, David Bowie. A new biography looks at his great coming-out decade, the 1970s.
Now Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the spiders from Mars. He played it left hand, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were Ziggy's band.
This hour on Point, we're looking back at Bowie. You can join the conversation. What was, is David Bowie to you? Freedom, fantasy, Starman? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Southampton, England, is Peter Doggett, music critic, cultural historian, and regular contributor to Mojo Magazine, Q, GQ. He's written on everyone from Lennon to Dylan to Elvis to Lou Reed. His latest book, and it's getting great reviews, is The Man Who Sold the World, David Bowie and the 1970s. Peter Doggett, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Well, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
This is by no means a straight-up biography. Tell us what you're up to here.
It's certainly not. No, this is not the book to go to if you want to find exactly who he slept with in the 1970s day by day or what drugs he was taking. There are lots of other books that tell those stories, and it's the same stories over and over again. I was very keen to focus on why we're actually still interested in David Bowie in the 21st century, which is the music and the power of his image. And so this is a very detailed study, song by song, of that incredible decade between the issue of Space Oddity in 1969 and then the Scary Monsters album in 1980.
The long 70s, as you call them, stretching a little bit longer than the numerical decade. I mean, you've got far from conventional biography here. The Observer, you know, reminds us you've got all the context here and essays on glam rock and minimalism and punk and radical left-wing politics. Sunday Times talking about music video, all these aesthetic traditions kind of coming into play with David Bowie. But remind us, just give us the basics to begin with. Get us up to your 70s. Is David Jones, 1947, born in Brixton. How does he become, just to begin with, he became so many things. How does he become David Bowie?
It's a long and complicated story. He's born into a very, very poor household, lived in a tiny little house in South London, in a family that unfortunately was marred by mental illness on his mother's side. And indeed, the story has it that when he was young, he was told by his mother, "You're bound to go mad. Everybody in our family goes mad eventually." He had a half-brother who he looked up to enormously. He was about 10 years older than him. And when David was in his early teens, his half-brother was his guide through what was happening in the world, really. He took him into central London, to jazz clubs and to folk clubs. He introduced him to the beat poets and existentialist writers and all this stuff. And then, unfortunately, by the late 60s, sure enough, his half-brother began to suffer from schizophrenia. So, I mean, that must have been a mind-boggling experience for David, to see somebody he respected so much, admired so much, falling prey to that terrible illness. And so I think that shadow of schizophrenia really helped to push him through the 70s, in that I think he felt he was working against the clock. He had to get as much done in a short amount of time as possible, because he never knew when the curtain was going to fall and he was going to follow other members of his family into madness.
You know, some, and David Bowie is not just anybody, but some might have responded to that fear, that threat, by gripping normalcy with all the greater fervor, you know, try and just be absolutely standard issue human being circa 1970. He went just the other way. Why did he go for these wild personas in the face of that fear of mental illness?
And not just the wild personas, he also later on in a decade pushed it to the limit with drugs as well. I mean, to the point of near madness, almost as if he was daring.
Was he tempting fate here?
Yeah, I think so. But I think the other great thing about Bowie, the positive thing, the thing that allowed him to survive this background, was his incredible creative imagination, I mean, which truly knew and knows no bounds. He was never somebody prepared to be sort of locked into a box and say, I just do hard rock, I don't do anything else. He always wanted to explore, to read something new, to hear something new. And so I think the excitement of it, of that exploration, of adventure, meant that he was prepared to take the risk and just push himself out there.
July 20th, 1969, first broadcast in England during the BBC's coverage of the moon landing, the American moon landing. David Bowie had written Space Odyssey as what he called the first anthem of the moon. Here's the original demo version, re-released on the deluxe edition of his self-titled album.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
And so it begins,
Tom.
Peter Doggett. We've got this persona, this character in space who does not want to come home. Tell us about this song and its origins.
Well, I was just going to say that the really interesting thing about the short fragment we've already heard is that the first voice on that record is not David Bowie's. It's actually a guy called John Hutchinson. And around the time that David wrote that song, he was very much planning to become half of a sort of Simon and Garfunkel type duo.
Who knew?
And they cut 7 or 8 demos together at this point. And then I think there were financial reasons why John Hutchinson couldn't stay in London and couldn't go through with it. And so that's why we had David Bowie as a solo artist. But I think the really interesting thing about the song is that if you go back to, I mean, I'm old enough to remember as a kid the space missions and so on, the sheer excitement around the world about that, the optimism about what was going to happen, the feeling that after we'd landed on the moon, mankind could do anything. And there in the middle of that, you've already got Bowie saying, if you go to the moon, it's just going to be lonely like it is here. So he was already seeing the dark side.
You describe him as one of the first prominent artists, or who would become prominent, to just walk away from the 60s, to go for something beyond the 60s utopianism and the 60s culture. Talk about cha-cha-cha changes, but he was eager and brave and ready and among the first to do that.
He was. I think he was slightly biased by the fact that since 1964 he had been trying very hard to become a pop star. And he made records that sound like the Beatles, some that sound like the Stones, the Who. He made sort of vaudeville-type records. And unfortunately, none of these had come across, at least until Space Oddity. So I guess he was a bit jaundiced about the 60s to begin with. But he also seemed to have an instinctive sense that although the fantasy was brilliant in the 60s, the idea we were all going to live together in peace and harmony, mm-hmm. it didn't bear any relation to the outside world. And so he was almost alone of his generation in at the height of that sort of counterculture idealism of saying, I don't think this is going to work. I think things are going to be much more grim ahead.
Here's the last song recorded for his 1970 album. It gives the title to Peter Doggett's new book. It's The Man Who Sold the World.
Spoke of was and when, although I wasn't there. He said I was his friend, which came as some surprise. I spoke into his eyes. I thought you died alone, a long, long time ago.
David Bowie's The Man Who Sold the World, 1970. You made it the title of your book. Why this one, Peter?
It's a great title anyway,
yes.
But also because it ties in with a a particular theme of mine throughout the book, I think, which is that when he left school at the age of 15, I think it was, he went into the centre of London and worked in an advertising agency. Now, this wasn't quite Don Draper and Mad Men.
Right.
Things in London were a lot more old-fashioned than they were in New York. And he was only there for a year, and he had relatively junior role there. But I'm sure he must have picked up so much about ways in which people can sell products and sell themselves as well. And I know for a fact that he actually spent a lot of his time when he was at work crafting out new images for the rock band he was in at the time, doing new logos, new uniforms. So I think that was a very important lesson for him at a very impressionable age.
Does it diminish what he is as an artist, that it's a kind of a sales job, or is it just the way you get it out there to the world?
I don't think it is in any way a negative thing. I don't think there's an artist who attempts to be in any way commercial who isn't trying to sell themselves. And certainly in rock terms, everybody falls into that league, whether it's Bob Dylan or the Beatles. He was just a lot more upfront about it.
Peter Doggett is with us from Southampton in England. His new book is The Man Who Sold the World, David Bowie in the 1970s. And it goes at many angles. We're going to dive right on in. Peter, please stand by there. Listeners, you can join us. What's Bowie mean to you? Is he freedom? Is he fantasy? Is he always something new? Changes? Were you there for his Earth landing, Ziggy Stardust, and all the rest? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Time takes a cigarette, puts it in your mouth, pull on your finger, then another finger, then your cigarette.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Ziggy Stardust, the starman David Bowie, and his greatest decade, the 1970s, the long 70s, as my guest Peter Doggett calls it, starting in 1969, right on through 80. He's out with a big new book, The Man Who Sold the World, David Bowie and the 1970s. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And it is getting rave reviews for looking at a man of such inventiveness against what he saw as the 60s, time for them to go, looking for something new. It got glam. It got, well, it got all kinds of colors and shapes. He joins us from Southampton, England today, and you can join us as well. Were you there for David Bowie's Earth landing, Ziggy Stardust? What did you think when he stepped up, when he stepped out? Was this the guy who ended the 60s? Showman, sex symbol, glam, surreal? And 20-30-somethings, how do you look at the young Bowie now? Does that persona still have pull? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Peter Doggett in Southampton, talk to us about this decade and the arc he took through it. There was so much inventiveness here. Our listener Ted says his favorite thing about Bowie is his constant fearlessness and reinvention. Begin to take us on the tour of this arc of reinvention, Peter.
Those are two really good words to describe him, actually, fearlessness and reinvention, exactly. He starts off, as I said already, as a sort of Simon and Garfunkel type singer-songwriter. He's a hard rocker on The Man Who Sold the World. Then he makes in Hunky Dory the album which is most like a follow-up to the Beatles' Abbey Road. And then he becomes Ziggy Stardust. And what you have to remember, it's quite hard to think back now to 1972, when he announced to the world that he was Ziggy Stardust superstar, he was not a star of any level, really,
yeah,
at all.
Yeah.
He was more or less forgotten as one hit wonder in England. He'd made no impact in the States whatsoever. So it required enormous courage then to sort of sell yourself to the world.
I mean, this now seems almost commonplace. You know, a lot of rappers do it. I mean, Lady Gaga's got her version of it. A lot of people assert that they're great stars now, but that took chutzpah. Ziggy Stardust from who knows where, and he's a superstar out of nowhere.
Yeah, and the incredible thing is that having got the world's attention in the summer of 72, within 12 months, he's had enough. He doesn't want to be Ziggy Stardust anymore. It would have been so easy for him to become Ziggy Stardust and just stay with that image until everybody got really bored with him. Instead of which, he does the album Aladdin Sane, which is a similar kind of thing. And from there, he's into Diamond Dogs, writing an album about the apocalypse based on George Orwell's 1984. Then he's in America working with great musicians like Earl Slick and pursuing a sort of R&B sound. With Station to Station in 76, he manages to wrap up everything he's done already and take it into an entirely new direction. And then when that's a chart-topping album around the world, he moves to Berlin and makes three really uncompromising records in the late 70s that almost dare his fans to ignore him. He's almost saying, see if you can take this. And then and then we end this sort of speed trip through the 70s with Bowie in 1980 with the Scary Monsters album, where he goes back to Major Tom, the character from Space Oddity, on the single Ashes to Ashes, yeah, and really sort of rounds everything up. And then he collapses in a heap for 2 or 3 years and says, that's it, I'm not making any more music.
Yeah. Roll it back to 1973 for a minute. Here he was on British television's ITV's Russell Hardy Plus. David Bowie here speaking pretty boyishly, you'll hear, with interviewer then Russell Hardy about his reception, fans and critics.
You split people down the middle, don't you, a lot? That is to say that people are hostile to you or they're totally indifferent.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
What kind of reaction do you get from the people who are violently in favour of you? I mean, do you get fan mail?
Yes, a lot.
What is it, scabrous or dangerous or interesting or exciting?
It's very sexy.
In what way?
I seem to draw a lot of fantasies out of people, and a lot of fan mail I get.
I seem to draw a lot of fantasies out of people. No kidding. I mean, I don't know how the reception was in the UK, but then and in decades after Peter Duggett, the sort of armies who march into David Bowie fantasy world and love it there are very impressive. How did he think about working that within himself and out to his audience?
I think he felt a really strong sense of identification with his audience, and he was the kind of artist who wants to take them with him, really, certainly for most of the decade. He wants to open their minds in the way that his imagination has been opened as well. But it was quite tough being one of his really, really diehard fans in the 70s, I think, because if you turned up at a concert on one tour with the previous tour's haircut, then you were just out. I mean,
Because it changed, and he loved that change, and he loved asserting those different personas, personalities. Here's from a 1975 documentary on the BBC, Cracked Actor, David Bowie talking about the importance of finding those multiple personalities within himself and inspiring others to do the same.
That's something I feel very strongly about, that one isn't totally what one has been conditioned to think one is. That there are many facets of the personality which a lot of us have trouble finding, and some of us do find too quickly.
Many aspects, including aspects of sexuality, which famously became part of his public story. Here's John, I'm Only Dancing. This is live, 1972, Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. This was released in 94. Take you way back. Well, let's hear.
And as her sweet chin always seems so mean till it comes on off a strong bench of life is put the song. Oh Lordy, oh Lordy, you know why it's a lovely. Move me, touch me. John, I'm only dancing. She turns me on, but I'm only dancing. She turns me on. But don't get me wrong, I'm only dancing.
She turns me on, but don't get me wrong. David Bowie, 1972, Santa Monica, and a song that seemed to be saying to a gay lover, I'm dancing with this girl, but don't get me wrong, I'm only dancing. Here he was coming out, his sexuality, bisexuality, kind of omnisexuality, Peter Douglas. Give us that arc.
Omnisexuality, indeed. I mean, at the start of 1972, when he was trying to sell Hunky Dory, and in the vain attempt to make that a hit record in Britain at that point, he gave a big interview in the magazine Melody Maker and said, "I'm gay, I'm bisexual, and I always have been." And this created a small stir, but at the same time, the press knew he was married, so there was confusion there from the start. And I think it was that confusion, that sort of, you weren't sure if he was from this planet or another one, you weren't sure if he was male or female, was what attracted so many people, particularly teenagers who are prone to sort of ambiguity about their own feelings.
Sure. And there he was, sort of playing it all out. Let's go to our listeners. We're going to hear in just a moment from the great guitarist Earl Slick. But first, Tess in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Tess, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. I listen to your show all the time.
Wonderful.
I wish I'd known this was going to be a Bowie show. I would have been better prepared. But
what, have all your makeup on or something, Tess? Yeah.
My favorite topic in the whole world, and so many people who know me think Bowie when they think Tess. So... I used to have a tess@davidbowie.com email address. So I was in the UK when Ziggy arrived, and really that image and the continuing image defined the 70s for me for sure. Huge center point of my life. That image of Ziggy and then Aladdin Sane was just so arresting, I think, in such a positive way. It was so appealing and alluring in a sexual but asexual way. The androgyny was so intriguing, and I think that those of us who got to see it in that era, it stays with us. It's one of those things that you can't lose. It's just phenomenal, ground-shaking. And I think there's many of us who are really shocked that the work he's done in the 2000s, the Heathen album he did after 9/11, never gets any airplay. He's done some phenomenal work. And I finally did get to meet him in 2002 at a small event and told him I'd been such a huge fan for 30 years. It was really cool to be close enough to meet him because those shows in the early days were so vast. And in the 2000s, he was playing very small venues. So.
Yeah, things changed. You got to meet him, Tess, and you carry him even on your email address. It's great to hear from you. And that androgyny, Tess, thank you, Tess, that androgyny that Tess points to, Peter, what was the precedent for that? Was there? How did people respond to it in the UK, in the US?
I think from the press, there was a deal of skepticism, and there was also some confusion. But from, as you just heard from Tess, from his fans, there was absolute acceptance. And there are so many people who've since come out who were teenagers when Bowie arrived. He was such an important role model for the likes of Boy George and so on. He really changed their lives.
And on it rolled in people's minds and in his performances. 1975, Young Americans. Here's David Bowie's dark, poetic, mythical Young Americans from the 1975 album of the same name.
But pulled in just behind the bridge, he lays her down. He frowns, gee, my life's a funny thing. Am I still too young? He kissed the woman there. She took his ring, took his babies. It took him minutes, took her nowhere. Heaven knows he'd have taken anything.
All night.
She was a young American.
1975, Young American, lead guitar on Young American, played by Earl Slick. Earl Slick joins us now from New York City, and we're so delighted to have him. Earl Slick, thank you very much for being here today.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
We're good. Give us some idea what that was like to be playing with Bowie at the sort of height of his fame and fantasy and challenge to the world. What was it like, Earl?
I gotta tell you, when it first came up, I was a bit dumbfounded by it because, you know, I had my own bands at the time, and my idea was I was going to make it with my own bands. But then this opportunity came by, and that kind of overshadowed pretty much everything. So, I mean, you know, obviously, was I 21 years old at the time?
Yeah.
I was, you know, happy to say the least.
Was Bowie off in his own world? Could he play the fantasy on stage and then be a regular Joe backstage or not?
At the beginning, no. He was not a regular Joe backstage, to be honest about it. As the years went on and we developed a relationship, you know, then there was the other part of David that I saw, which was, you know, a lot different than the stage persona. But at the beginning, you're going to go back to Diamond Dogs days and all that whole period, it was the character almost took over, you know, pretty much 24/7.
What were you and the other, you know, instrumental musicians thinking? I mean, were you like rolling with it? Like, wow, this is great. Or were you thinking, I don't know what's up with this guy, but let's play?
No, it just seemed perfectly normal to all of us, you know. I mean, we were playing rock and roll and doing what a bunch of 21-year-olds do when you're in a situation like that, which we were playing rock and we were having a ball.
I guess you would have been. Janet, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on with Peter Doggett and Earl Slick. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment about that Diamond Dogs tour. I was in New York working for a lighting company. We were doing the dress rehearsals right outside New York City of that tour.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to say about him is about his theatricality. He was not just a rock and roll performer.
Yeah.
He was working with the best lighting designer of the time, Jules Fisher. He created a set piece, which was a velvet-colored, larger than, 7-foot-high, 8-foot-high, 10-foot-high hand that was also covered in twinkling lights. It rolled out from the back of the stage at the beginning of the opening act, and it turned around. It rotated slowly around, and then it came down, and David walked off of that hand wearing complete white against this dark sky with twinkling lights. He was just and I was there at the dress rehearsal.
It's a great image.
It was just something to see them work on that piece.
Oh, no kidding. And the way you describe it, did you think at the time we're in new territory here? Did you see glam rock unfolding in that? Or was it just part of the
I just saw a bridge between music and serious theater, serious theatrical work that, you know, music, rock and roll music was not just rock and roll music, but it was art, you know, and he brought in so many of the arts into his set, you know, he, the costumes and the lighting and of course the sound, you know,
of course,
but
the whole thing
was really very sophisticated.
Janet, you're great. Earl Slick, looking back on it now, do you see that the artist, the performance artist at work here?
Absolutely. I mean, because up until that point, I mean, people had, like, you know, lighting and costumes and stuff like that, you know, because the glam thing was already in progress.
Mm-hmm.
But what David did was far beyond what anybody else had done up to that point. I would absolutely say that was the trigger. That was the first one that David went to lengths that nobody else had gone to in a rock and roll show as far as going to theater, which if you take that, and then you see what happened over the years. Even the Rolling Stones, you know, going into more elaborate stage sets, you know, that was the beginning. That was the benchmark right there.
Earl Slick, it's an honor to have you for a couple of minutes here. We're very grateful to you for taking time out to do it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The great guitarist Earl Slick, he was there with Bowie on Young America and Station to Station, much more. Peter Doggett, what about that era when Earl and Bowie were on stage together?
Earl Slick is such an amazing guitarist. The energy, the sort of muscularity that he brought to Bowie's music is incredible. But your previous caller was talking about the image, the stage image of the Diamond Dogs tour, and that really reflected Bowie's enormous interest in the German expressionist filmmakers of the 20s. Everything was very stark, black and white. Mm-hmm. And that's just one really good example of how his sort of wider, beyond music influences came into his rock and roll career.
We'll look more at that. We're going to go out of this segment with 1976 Fame. This was lip-synced live on Soul Train. Earl Slick on guitar here. And some of the lip-syncing got a little crazy. We've got people writing in and say he was so coke-stoked he couldn't lip-sync. What do you say, Peter?
I'm saying nothing.
Okay. As you like it. We're talking about David Bowie in his maybe greatest decade. Peter Doggett's new book is The Man Who Sold the World, David Bowie and the 1970s. You can join us. What did you make of Bowie's sexuality? Was it show? Was it real? Did it matter? Where did David Bowie in that decade take you. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Peter Doggett, please stand by in Southampton. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about David Bowie in the 1970s, Ziggy Stardust, the Starman, much more, maybe his greatest decade. Peter Doggett, the great British writer, writes about it very compellingly in his new book, The Man Who Sold the World, David Bowie in the 1970s. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Behind us right here, Sound and Vision, 1977 from the album Low. No vocals for nearly half the song. We'll ask why. You can join us. Where did David Bowie take you? Where does he take you? Now, how do you look back on him, all that? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Peter, I want to talk about this song, but some of the response from our listeners here first. Here's Jennifer says, Bowie purposefully never embraced one era or locked himself into one style, allowed fans like Jennifer to find him years after his big 70s era and still connect. It is interesting. I mean, people who had nothing to do with that time, who were not born, still find their connection and lock in, Peter.
I've certainly found that with my own children, in fact, and with their generation, young people in their early 20s, who are absolutely fascinated by Bowie's music, and that goes way beyond the sort of surface of the image or the sexual ambiguity. There's something unsettling and captivating about his music that reaches out way beyond its time.
We've got another listener who writes, Bowie lives his life, as if he is still figuring it all out. How exhilarating to view such an honest attempt of raw existence in a modern-day human being, an understanding that no one has to be alienated. Has he ever talked about exactly that? I mean, how self-revealing is he with you or others, Peter, in how he sees what he's been up to?
Well, he does not give interviews anymore. So, I mean, his life now is entirely private, and I really respect that decision he's made. But certainly in the 70s, particularly, he gave lots and lots of interviews, and they all contradicted each other. He was quite capable of telling one story in the morning and an entirely different one in the afternoon, which I guess, in a way, reflects the sort of multifaceted character. But this song that we're talking over is really interesting because the key motif of the song is I'm waiting for the gift of sound and vision. Yeah. It's a song about trying to feel creative, and it was actually this song that broke a creative block that had lasted about 12 months.
He was in Berlin, I think, when he...
Yes, he was on his way to Berlin, certainly. He made Station to Station. He'd made the film The Man Who Fell to Earth in America, and he'd come very close to toppling over the edge of insanity and chemical excess, and he needed to go somewhere fresh, an entirely new sort of way of looking at the world. And so rather than coming back to London, which was the obvious thing to do, he went to Berlin, which was then and is still now an edgy and exhilarating city, and he soaked up all sorts of different influences, both political and social and musical and artistic.
And had to live through that kind of lapse in his enormous creativity. Nashville, Tennessee, Dan is calling. Dan, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to say that David Bowie was a great, just a great example for us. We were all still in the kind of the Southern rock hippie mode, and, you know, we were still doing all that, but he gave us another kind of metaphor, you know, and there were a lot of people who were coming out at that time and
coming out as gay.
As gay. Mm-hmm. My ex-wife at that time was, you know, her and her her partner came out and my marriage split up. But we, you know, David Bowie was like, we were going to Mardi Gras every year in those days. And he was kind of like the soundtrack for Mardi Gras, you know. It was, and it was just a time of, you know, identity shifting and some confusion and lots of changing. And it was great to have a cultural icon, you know, to give us a, way to deal with all of that.
Kind of identity liberation. Dan, you take us right back to that. You and many others, I appreciate that very much from Nashville. Here's a little bit. This was Bowie in New York. It's 74. He was on the Dick Cavett Show. And he talked with Cavett about living as a gay man in America and England.
When you walk around New York and a hard hat says, hey, sweetheart, you know.
I drive around New York.
That's great. Good idea. What do your parents do for a living?
Well, my father's dead, and my mother, I think she's got a day job.
Does she have trouble explaining you to the neighbors who say, are you any relation to that?
I think she pretends I'm not hers.
I think she pretends I'm not hers. Jackson in Braintree, Vermont. Jackson, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks
Hi.
For taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to share my experience of coming to David Bowie in my 20s when I was in college. I'm in my 30s now, so I haven't been out very long, but it was my senior year, and a friend's band, a very good band, played their final show, and they chose to do the entire Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust album in costume with makeup, and it was the first time I had ever heard the music of David Bowie in any sort of length, and it blew me away, and their renditions were spot on. Since then, I've picked up the album, and it's one of my favorite albums of all time, and it was just a tremendous introduction to some incredible music, but it came, you know, I missed the first round, so I had to catch it later on in life.
And it feels fresh enough to you, Jackson, at your young age? You don't feel lost in the past listening to it?
Absolutely not. I think it's one of the, I have young kids now, and we listen to Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust all the time. It's a favorite in our house, and it just, there's something about it that is timeless, and it sounds like nothing else I've ever heard, and that's the kind of music I'm drawn to all the time. So it absolutely is timeless to me.
Keeps rolling. We've got questions for Peter Doggett. Jackson, thanks for that. Here in 1977 from Heroes, David Bowie's recorded in West Berlin at that time, Bowie's Kraut Rock inspired Joe the Lion. Peter Doggett, you remind us there was a lot of ferment here. 1974, performance artist Chris Burden had nailed himself to the roof of his Volkswagen Beetle in Venice, California. There was a lot going on. Here's Bowie in West Berlin, Krautrock, as in German rock, I guess. What's going on in this, around this song's time, Peter?
Well, there's so much happening. Just even in this song, you mentioned the performance artist who inspired those couple of lines. You have to remember that Bowie's son, who was originally christened as Zoe Bowie, his other name was Joe, so maybe there's a link there as well.
Yeah.
And the thing about this song, there's a great line in it where he says, you wake up and sleep. And his message is, too many people sleep through their lives. Mm-hmm. They wake up, they just go through the motions every day, and then they die. And his thing is always, use your imagination, expand your life, use every second to its utmost. And that, I think, is the most positive message for any artist to give the rest of the world.
You know, you've written on so many fronts. You've written about Lou Reed. We've got one listener here, Corvus, says he's not a fan. Says Bowie is a poser, which he couldn't help. Lou Reed was the real item. Well, you're in a position to compare and contrast. What do you say, Peter?
I think Lou Reed was the real item, but the fact that he's still playing the rebellious, unfriendly, snarling rock and roll dude, and he's 70, you know, he should grow up.
How about Bowie's evolution on those terms?
I think the way he's handled himself has been extremely dignified by comparison, as shown by the fact that he's not one of those artists who's going out flogging himself to death on the rock touring circuit.
Yeah.
he could be making millions and millions and millions of dollars just going through the motions, playing the same old songs in the same old arrangements, and he's decided that's not what he wants to do with his life, so he doesn't do it. And I've got, as I said earlier, enormous respect for that decision.
Jason in Huntingburg, Indiana. Jason, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you. I was just going to comment on the fact that, you know, being from a very rural area and being brought up listening to, you know, country and everything else, that David Bowie sort of, you know, gets somebody out of their regular kind of style of listening and making them change and be more cultural. Thank you.
I appreciate that, Jason. It's great to hear from you. Was he deliberate about that? I mean, you know, we're used to these days, Lady Gaga, Born This Way, making it a kind of an explicit anthem, you know, that she's there as a kind of a torch for those who want to explore different sides of themselves, live differently. Was Bowie that explicit about it, Peter?
I think he was more instinctive. I think he just followed his imagination. With Lady Gaga, and this is not a criticism, I think she's a lot more calculated, because once someone like Bowie has done that, it's not enough just to do it again. You have to do it in a more extreme way or a more interesting way. And, I mean, she's a really interesting figure in that she changes image a lot and so on. But as yet, for my listening, at least my taste, I haven't heard her come out with the music that is deep enough or compelling enough to go with the image.
Neil in Waxhaw, North Carolina. Neil, you're on. Hi, Neil. Are you there, my friend?
Yes, Tom. Thank you. What a great topic you have today. Bowie is kind of like the hidden fifth Beatle. I mean, you have the Beatles, the Who, the Stones, and so forth. But people forget what a revolutionary Bowie was. And in that vein, we talk about the coaching trees of Dean Smith or Mike Krzyzewski or Bobby Knight, but the influence that Bowie had on Elton John and Michael Jackson and others is just tremendous, and his tree must be gargantuan.
if you could trace the tree, it is a big one. No kidding. Peter, how do you do that? How do you sort of trace the Bowie legacy through the rest of the music world?
It's so large, it's almost impossible to draw, in fact. I mean, you can do it in very simple terms. I mean, we've already talked about Lady Gaga. Mm-hmm. In the 80s, lots of the British bands who came out then, not my favorites, but people like Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet, they were very influenced by Bowie.
Sure.
But I think anybody who's ever taken a left field turn, anybody who's ever taken a chance as a musician has got some of Bowie's spirit inside him.
And his synthesis, Black and White, I mean, you could go on around that to Prince and Madonna and U2.
Exactly, with Prince particularly, because he touched on lots of the same stuff a few years after Bowie. He was writing songs about sexual ambiguity, and, you know, he wasn't quite sure if he was black or white. I mean, obviously he is black, but he was toying with rock, with funk, in exactly the same way Bowie had done two or three years earlier.
When Bowie put all of his influences together, I mean, there he is sort of working with Andy Warhol. You can feel that. There's a lot of America in there. You write about his fascination with fascism, with Jack Kerouac's On the Road, with the occult, with Nietzsche. Was he just soaking all this up? Was he on a deliberate sort of pilgrimage to find influences? How did it work?
He was on a pilgrimage not so much to find influences as just to discover something new, something that was going to excite him and inspire him. And so, as I think I said earlier, he just always wanted to read a new book, to see new art he'd never seen before, to hear music. And so he's the opposite of every artist in whatever genre who says, I just do this very narrow thing. He was always as wide as he could possibly be.
1980, coming toward the end of your long 70s for David Bowie, here's a Fashion off of Scary Monsters and Super Creeps.
They do it over there, but we don't do it here.
David Bowie, 1980, fashion. Curtain coming down here on the long 70s, Peter Doggett describes. There's a brand new dance. It's big and it's bland, full of tension and fear. Where's he headed here, Peter?
Those lines are great, aren't they? Well, he's definitely making the fashion and fascism comparison. It's interesting because so many people, the people who don't get Bowie, think, oh, he's just surface, he's just style, he's just fashion. And this was his way of saying, fashion is nothing, it's what's inside that counts.
What happened at the end of the 80s? Did he just run out of steam? He sort of changed. I mean, you switch off there and you call it a day for your investigation. Why?
Because I felt that the music he made between 69 and 80, that long 70s, is very much one big art project. It belongs together. Mm-hmm. Then he had two or three years when he concentrated on doing films. And then when he came back with Let's Dance in 83, he was like a different guy. He looked different, he sounded different. But it was interesting. I think it was your very first caller, whose name I've forgotten, sadly, who was talking about the music he'd made in the 21st century. And I think if you listen to the records that Bowie made from 95 onwards, five or six albums through to his retirement about in 2005, 2006, that's some of the most interesting and unusual and inventive music of his career. But unfortunately, it didn't reach the same mass audience.
And in your 70s, you write about the terrible effect of cocaine, amphetamines. How close did he finally come to the edge? He feared that mental illness, maybe even schizophrenia. How close did he come to the edge?
His aides, his people around him, were extraordinarily worried about him. For much of the 70s, he was a man who didn't eat, he didn't sleep, he just wanted to work all the time. And I just say thank goodness he left California in 76, because otherwise I don't think we would still have David Bowie today.
But we do, and new generations just keep coming to it. David, Peter Doggett, it's really quite a tour, not just of the biographical elements, but all the cultural elements that go in, sort of song by song. Terrific analysis here in the new book, The Man Who Sold the World, David Bowie in the 1970s. It's been great to have you, Peter. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Listeners, a terrific excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. That was Peter Doggett joining us today from Southampton, England. Thanks for joining us. We'll go out with a rare U.S. single version of Rebel Rebel from 1974's Diamond Dogs. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.